Hey folks, Damian Mason coming at you. Before we hop into another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture, I want to tell you about Pattern Ag. Pattern Ag is a company that has pioneered predictive soil analytics. You know, we always treated diseases and pests after they were already in the field, when they were already causing us a problem. But what if you can do this proactively through predictive soil analytics? Pattern has a technology that through their technology, you can say, oh, here's the likelihood that I'm going to have soybean cyst nematode. Here is the prediction on how bad of a risk I face for sudden death syndrome or corn rootworm and a whole bunch of other diseases and pests. When you know what your risk factor is, you can more efficiently and proactively treat for the disease. You can do this by going to pattern.ag and figuring out what your risk factors are through predictive analytics. That's right. Go to www.pattern.ag and then get a hold of your Pattern Ag representative to help you do predictive analytics on your farming operation. Well, greetings and welcome to another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. It's me, Damian Mason. You already knew that. You heard it in the introduction. I've got a great program for you today because we're talking about elevating ag one video and one fact at a time. I've got Natalie Kovarik, I hope I'm saying that correctly, and Tara Vanderdusen. They are famous. They're also all over Instagram. They're more than just Instagram starlets. They're not what you'd call the Kardashians of ag, because let's face it, the Kardashians are imbeciles. These two chicks are smart. Tara is a dairy farmer in New Mexico, and Natalie is a beef rancher in Nebraska. We just frankly met before I started recording this, but I knew who they were and they kind of knew who I was because of what we all do. And what we do is we talk about the business of agriculture in different formats and different capacities and frankly to different audiences. But that's why we're bringing us together, to bring them to you and you to me and all that kind of stuff. Tara and Natalie, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
All right. Quick biographical before we get into elevating ag one video at a time. You came across my radar a couple of years ago, Tara. I'm not sure exactly how, but then I thought, okay, this lady is in the dairy business. I'm a dairy farm kid. I rent my farm ground to a large scale Dutch dairyman, because as we all know, Holland leads the world in exports of dairy farmers. And so you're married to a Dutch dairy farmer. You are a Dutch dairy farmer. And for some reason you came across my feed and I'm like, oh, this is interesting. So give me the background beyond that.
Yeah. So I'm a fifth generation dairy farmer. My husband is as well. My dad is actually first generation in the United States. So my grandparents dairy farmed in the Netherlands. And my dad still has first cousins dairy farming there. So very connected to Dutch Netherlands, dairy farms in the Netherlands. But my story is I actually left the farm and got a degree in environmental science. And I have spent the last 12 years working as an environmental consultant for dairy farms throughout New Mexico and the Southwest, assisting with manure management, soil conservation, water conservation. And about 7 years ago, I just started seeing more and more misinformation about dairy farming online and wanted to kind of share what it was actually looking like, what was actually happening on these dairy farms and our impact on the environment. And so that was kind of, you know, the start of many new things to come from there. I'll let Natalie jump in a little bit about her.
By the way, and if you wonder, dear listener, this is not going to be a powder puff podcast. We're getting to some hard data and we're going to talk about stuff that these girls have been keeping up with as well as me and as well as you. For instance, since we have a woman here of Dutch heritage, we're going to talk about the European Union's push to the Netherlands to lower their environmental footprint by basically seizing farms and livestock, forced liquidations of livestock. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about United Nations push to tax meat animals. We're going to talk about the population bomb that is not. We're going to talk about labor issues. We're going to talk about environmentalism, or shall we say misguided environmentalism. We're going to talk about meat. We got a lot of stuff, a lot of meat in this podcast. So just in case you were wondering where we're going before we, before we lost you, Natalie Kovarik, you get paid by Boot Barn to talk about their products. I got to say, man, you've made me wonder if I need to be like upping my cowboy boot collection. I've only got three pairs. So anyway, take me away. Besides getting Natalie, besides getting Boot Barn sponsorship, tell me what you got going on.
Just a few other things, I suppose. I, like Tara, was raised in agriculture, actually Southwest Montana. So I am a Nebraska transplant. I grew up fourth generation there. My husband's technically fifth, but the operation we run here is first, which is kind of cool because I've had exposure to, you know, the longstanding history in agriculture, but also very experienced with what it takes to get an operation off the ground up and running. And both of them are, you know, same, but different. Unlike Tara, I kind of stumbled my way into advocating online. I actually started sharing for a direct-to-consumer beef company I started a couple of years ago and then pivoted from that to share more personally. And I don't know, you just, when you get online and you start putting yourself out there, start seeing some of the information, if you're a little bit like Tara and I, which are strong personalities, you can't help but just kind of take a stance for what you're passionate about. And so I never intended to advocate in the way I do, but here I am.
And you do a fine job. And I want to get into the struggle with that. But before I get into that, you're like a pharmacist or something.
Yes. Yeah. That's
she always forgets to mention that.
All right. Let's talk about the things that we see. And like I said, we come at it from different angles. I write books and I started this podcast 5.5 years ago and I tend to have a little bit more edge. You two are, less hard edged than me sometimes from what I see, but I think we all communicate, the same data and the same facts and the same things that we see. And then we kind of share that with who keeps up with our stuff. I a lot of times look at what I do and think I'm a dot connector. I'm a Cliff's Notes. I mean, I read profusely. I mean, I'm on airplanes, business journals. I read stuff that ag people don't see. So a lot of times I'm in front of my ag audiences and I say, who has seen this issue in the Netherlands? And nobody raises their hands. And I say, okay, who's seen this thing about the United Nations now having hearings on greenhouse gas emissions and talking about how wealthy countries should tax meat? And they all just look at me. I'm like, you're very siloed, you people. You need me. And I don't look at it as advocating. I look at it as informing our people about the bigger world. And I'm not saying that they're dumb. I'm not saying that they're under rocks. They get busy doing what they do. They milk cows, they grow soybeans, whatever. And I'm like the conduit that's saying, are you seeing this? And now let me connect the dot as to why that matters to you. Do you feel like you're dot connecting or do you feel like I'm coming at it from a different angle than what you come at it? Give me your perspective on what you do and then how we all do it.
Yeah. So I would say in some ways we have some similarities there. So with our podcast, Discover Ag, every week we highlight 3 news articles of things you need to know. And we've actually covered almost every single one you just said, you know, what's going on in the Netherlands. That one we've actually covered multiple times just because it keeps new things keep happening with that one. Taxes, you know, in New Zealand, in Ireland. So very similar things. I would say we're coming at it from a different angle. If you're not watching this, you know, Natalie and I are both in our mid-30s, obviously women. And so where we're coming at it from is really trying to connect with our like women of our age and women in ag, as well as women outside of ag. I think is one thing we've been trying to do is when we approach our conversation is bring a little bit of where we can connect with our urban counterparts and maybe get them interested in some of these things that are going on, not only in the US, but around the world related to ag.
Natalie.
Yeah. I mean, I'll echo that. I think that, you know, when you're putting yourself out on these social platforms, I think it can go to the level of nuance you want to take it, right? So you could stay safe and talk about issues that maybe affect you locally or things that, you know, producers are more aware of, or you can really put yourself out there and you can cross the pond and talk about things that are going on, you know, on a nation or worldwide level. And so I think it just depends. And it's almost the same with advocating. I think sometimes we want to put our head down and kind of hide from some of the issues out there. And sometimes people are out there with sticking their noses into places they shouldn't be. You know, it just depends on how far you want to go into some of these issues.
Tara, when I ran across you a couple of years ago, I sent you a message and I said, I hope that you're not working for the checkoff programs. And I know you probably want me to talk about this on your website or your podcast, but you can talk about it on my podcast. I've been critical of at least a couple of the various checkoff programs for a lack of efficiency. More importantly, a lack of maximizing promotional dollars or not even necessarily understanding the marketplace. You are out here in a pretty different capacity. And I got to say that checkoff dollars would not, and that was my concern, they would not back you because the checkoff programs aren't allowed to disparage any other commodity, aren't allowed to take anything that might be misconstrued. And so they're so controlled that they lose any ability they could even be effective. If you gave the same rules to Coca-Cola, you know, they'd be like, hell, I can't sell soda pop. And so your thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is such a good conversation. Natalie and I have talked a lot about checkoff, and it's interesting to see the differences between beef checkoff and dairy checkoff. So we've actually gotten into some very interesting conversations around that.
Did you disagree? Did you ever like get mad at each other and like not talk for a couple of days?
No, I think I guess we agree, but it's interesting to see the differences. It's a there's a lot of differences between beef and dairy, and that's been interesting to go into, I guess, a little bit between each other. But I will say, I think I should probably have this disclaimer. I'm recording this the day after I found out I'm officially on the DMI board, which is the Dairy Management Inc. board. So I am the bad guy, I guess, the checkoff bad guy. But no, I think that I come to this conversation with, seeing a lot of different sides. I've had checkoff really help me. I think there's things that they could really do differently. I think there's exactly, like you said, very frustrating things about checkoff that they cannot outright pay farmers to do promotion. They cannot talk about another commodity. I mean, the list goes on and on of all the things they cannot do. Right. So honestly, the reason I applied to be on the board is coming at it from both those sides. I know how they've supported me, and I know how I would like to see things done differently.
Natalie? This is where I want you to say, that's bullshit. You know what, Tara? Let's face it. You know what? Go ahead.
No, I'll be pretty politically correct, PC. I'll say the same thing, that I have had really great support. We were fairly involved at like our local cattlemen's level. But I think with any organization, you know, the further up you go, the more kind of diluted it can get, I guess, or harder to work with them and see support. But yeah, there are frustrations with it, but there's also pros to it. And I think at the end of the day, I'll always say that I'm happy that there's at least an organization advocating on our behalf, even if there is things that could be done differently or better. I would rather someone out there advocating for us than, you know, none. Especially in the beef industry, I feel like we're already so segmented as it is, which is one of the differences I think that Tara and I have talked about between, you know, beef and dairy, is dairy seems a lot more consolidated and a little bit more together, whereas I feel like beef, we're kind of scattered. We have a lot of different opinions we're trying to make happen. We're having a lot of different opinions coming to the table. So
Natalie, don't you think, I mean, since Tara and I are both dairy people and you're a beef person, don't you think really what you're talking about is dairy people are smarter than beef people? You know, that really what it comes down to?
That's what I was trying to say. That's exactly what you found my words for me.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of, I think Tara and I basically were giving each other the knowing nod that we're like, yeah, well, what you're really talking about is the fact that just dairy people are smarter than beef people. Anyway, that's all right. Hey, advocating. And you just said something, Natalie said, advocating on our behalf, having our back, et cetera, et cetera. And this might get a little touchy, but that's okay. We're all friends here. I have had a very common gripe against the checkoff program since they came into incarnation about the time that you two were born in the 1980s. Grew up on a dairy farm. Every person I knew that had a pro dairy bumper sticker on the refrigerator or a dairy thing was a dairy producer. And so I'm like, you know, I'm like a freshman in college taking my first marketing classes. I'm like, why are you going and marketing to the people that are already pretty fully vested? They are the producers. And checkoff is famous for this, depending on more so in some commodities than the other. And don't you think that's one of the big problems? We talk about being on advocating on behalf of agriculture, but a lot of people that keep up with your stuff are already fully vested. They are agriculture people. You don't need to tell them that ag's good. Tell me about that, your thoughts.
I would say that that's actually probably the biggest hurdle we see in agriculture, like you mentioned, in a lot of different faucets, is our echo chamber, which is great. Like ag supports ag, but we've got to figure out how to break through it. I'll never forget. I was actually at a conference and the speaker presenter showed a video of a YouTube chef and asked, you know, to raise the hands of how many people in the room knew who this person was. And there was maybe like five people that knew who this chef was. And then he turned it over and showed the Peterson Farm Brothers, who are very big on YouTube. And everyone in the room raised their hands and said who they, you know, knew who they were. Well, the chef, he averaged probably 5 million views a video. I mean, the largest personality you could get out there on the platform, advocating, not, I wouldn't say like for agriculture, but a lot of his food was centered around beef. So definitely a proponent for our industry. No one in the room knew who it was. Like, if that is someone agriculture should be behind, right? Sharing those videos, promoting that person, using those recipes, no one knew who he was. And so I do think that that is a huge hurdle. And something we try and actually talk about on our online course, Elevate Ag, that, you know, helps producers share is like, how can you break that echo chamber? How can you get out there and advocate to people, you know, that isn't already supporting you? Cause like you said, it just does no good. I mean, it's great, but we've got to reach further. Like, our ripple effect has to be bigger.
Tara?
Yeah, I have a lot of things to say on this. I actually think that checkoff may not be the problem as much as the people, the farmers that may be on the board or are supporting checkoff. I've had a lot of conversations with people where checkoff, you know, wants to do new things. They want to try and reach out into new things. But if you're controlled by a board that, you know, no offense to you, but older men are not always in touch with what's going on. And so when checkoff will put out these ideas, you know, these board members are like, no one's there. Like, I still see so many times where people are like, why aren't we still doing Got Milk campaigns? And it's like, because while those were really popular, they didn't work. And so checkoff like didn't actually tell you anything about milk or dairy or how it's good for you or any of these things. It just was a celebrity.
I realize as a millennial female, you had to bring it to the demographic of me being a white male. Anyway, aside from any of that, let's talk about the demographics. The reality is you're making it, or I'm sorry, you're not making it, because we're not disagreeing. In fact, I'm in quite agreement with you. And I can talk about this with a lot of groups. I'm involved with Extreme Ag. It's Ag Guys. And we talk about marketing what we do. And I made a point here, and I've certainly made it to the boards you're talking about, Tara. I'm like, all right, you sell 8,000 gallon tanker loads of milk. I get it. You sell stuff and you sell cull cows every month to the sale barn. You know, you sell stuff, but what have you ever sold? And they're like, what? I say, this is the problem. Producers in agriculture tend to be amazing producers, and they do sell stuff, but they don't sell. They don't market. They're not promoters, and they have a hell of a hard time looking at them, at their product from the consumer standpoint. So that's really what your bigger point is, Tara, is the demographic, whether it's old guys or whatever, is that they don't really ever understand selling. I'm fortunate. I've been selling the services of my own business for 3 decades, and I was in corporate sales prior to that. And I write books about business. Then I think a lot of our people that are in ag production lack the sales gene, and it's not in any way a crack on. It's not what they're programmed to do. Your husband is a, what'd you say, a fourth generation, whatever, dairy farmer. They're darn good at producing, generally don't think in terms of promotion. They're producers, not promoters. And I think that's maybe the bigger thing on this front. But I wanted to interrupt with that. Tara or Natalie, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think that my husband is the first one actually to be like, I shouldn't be on the promotion board. I don't know anything about it. He's like, you should be who you're seeing, what the back end of Facebook, Instagram, TikTok looks like, what's spiking, what's trending. And I think that's something that Natalie and I actually tried to really bring to our podcast as well. I mean, people may laugh that last week we covered Lindsay Lohan drinking Pepsi with milk, but our target audience is millennial women who grew up with Lindsay Lohan. So we're trying to reach outside of that ag bubble kind of by bringing in some of this like pop culture entertainment along with ag news. Like for us, that's really that melding of those two like cultures, agriculture and pop culture, is really where we like see ourselves thriving. And I'll let Natalie kind of add to that.
Yeah, I mean, mine might be a little bit of a tangent, but I would even argue that, you know, your statement
more of a tangent than she just went on.
that production versus selling, or, you know, producing versus selling is maybe even a reason why you're seeing some, you know, farmers and ranchers struggling in this business, is because sometimes people are good at producing and they're not good at marketing and they don't understand that business aspect. I talked to my husband about that over and over again, about how, like, if you look at the dollar amount our business is, you know, what our actual business is, it's like, are we running it like that? Are we treating it like that? Do we have a CEO? You know, like, how are we running these business in agriculture actually like businesses, or are we just producing something?
You talked about polling your audience. One thing I love to poll when I give speeches, my audience is, when was the last time any of them were in the grocery store?
By the way, that's the one I was going to just bring up, and you beat me to the punch. When I was involved in some milk promotion work, I'm like, well, how come we're not seeing her ad? I'm like, why would I need to advertise to you? You, when's the last time you went to the store and bought a gallon of milk? Well, I'm like, yeah, you see, they understand. Speaking of, well, first off, we got a lot of stuff we're going on here. Before we get too off the rails here, I want to remind our listeners a stat that I was given. 19% of a farmer's time or rancher's time is spent trying to find answers to questions. So my buddy, Rob Syke, an Alberta agricultural entrepreneur, he started like 18 different companies. A couple of years ago, he says, I'm going to start a company that helps shorten time and distance. And I'm going to help people do that by using their phone. AgVisor Pro is an app. It's very, very simple. You just go on your app store and you find AgVisor Pro. You can become an expert, or let's say I need somebody that's an expert in ragweed eradication. Boom, you can find somebody. Oh, you can go on Twitter and type in Ag Twitter. How do I get rid of these ragweeds? And you'll get ridiculed by all the know-it-all dumbasses that are on Twitter that just think that you're dumb for even asking a question. Or you can go on AgVisor Pro, find a qualified ragweed eradication expert. And you know what? You can connect and get the information you need. AgVisor Pro. It is not just about ragweed eradication. It's about finding information, shortening time and distance, which makes you money and makes you more efficient. AgVisor Pro. Check it out. All right. We've been getting along pretty well. I mean, I'd say that so far it hasn't been anything too bad. What do you think, Natalie?
Yeah. I don't know if that's good or bad that we have same viewpoints, though.
All right, let's talk about big issues and going to your Dutch heritage.
Okay.
Not enough people are paying attention to this. I started seeing this in the summer, and that was not the first time we had seen this. The European Union, 42 countries, roughly 29, whatever it is. The point is the European Union is now breathing down the throat, the necks, if you will, of the Dutch and saying you're too many greenhouse gas emissions. And the Holland, many people, as you know, Tara, don't know that Holland is the Netherlands and Dutch people come from there because they say, oh, them Dutch people are from Denmark. Okay. Anyway, so there is a big push and they have a person called a Minister of Environment and Emissions, for God's sakes, that is now pushing this. And one of her quotes was, yes, there will be forced liquidation to farms, but you know what? That's just what we need to do for the greater good. When I start hearing greater good, it reminds me straight out of a science fiction movie. I'm terrified because also this same movement is jumping the pond. Trudeau's government in Canada is talking about a similar thing. Got to eliminate nitrous oxide emissions, blah, blah, blah. We're going to save the world. And the bigger part, of course, is this is such heavy-handed environmental Gestapo tactics. They're talking about forcibly liquidating your asset. Your thoughts?
Oh man, there's so many directions. I'm like chomping at the bit to get started on this. We've been covering this story for a while and all of the details of it progressing. I mean, this is not a new story either. This is, I mean, 2018, the farmers in the Netherlands started protesting.
It's coming to a head now, yes. But it's been in the works for multiple years.
I do think we're not paying enough attention to it in the United States. I can't believe how many times when I talk with farmers, they don't know what's going on. And I'm like, it is the writing on the wall. If we are not watching what's going on in the Netherlands, like it's coming. It's coming down the pipeline, I think, in other places and other countries as well. The quotes from the minister of, what was it? I forget exactly hers, but yeah, the emissions lady, her quotes are pretty terrifying if you start getting into them. I mean, she basically was like, this is the best offer you're going to get. So take it or leave it. And like, yes, if we have to forcibly seize these lands, we will. There's some scary things happening. And I think what's difficult is, you have these, you know, the UN, the EU, these big organizations that are just taking a very, like we talked about this before we got on air, black and white approach to greenhouse gases. That they're basically like, you cannot put a number on cattle that is as simple as greenhouse gases. They're a part of the greater food system, the greater ecosystem. It is so much more nuanced than just black and white greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah. So I don't know if everyone listening knows this, but the Netherlands are actually the second largest exporter of agriculture goods. They're just right behind the US.
I would like to point out, Natalie, the second largest in terms of dollar, in terms of value, they're not necessarily in terms of quantity because they tend to be very high value goods. And when you think about how smart that is, The Netherlands is one third the size of my home state of Indiana. You're talking about 17 million people in a very small area, and they're the number two value-wise exporter in the world by the United States. It's a huge accomplishment when you think about it.
Right. And one thing Tara and I always will stand behind and talk about is that you should not be asking people or countries, nations that are, what's the right words? They are good at what they do. Like, we have it figured out. We should not be taking people that and then offsetting those carbon emissions, essentially. Right. So if the Netherlands decreases, we're going to be moving them to somewhere else.
Well, it's offshoring. But I think the word you're looking for is proficient.
Yes. Thank you. That is the word I'm looking at.
OK, so you're looking for proficient. And the other thing is, you're not talking about that anybody's going to go without the calories that they're producing in the Netherlands. You're talking about now those hog farms, those dairy production facilities, move to Brazil, where they're slashing and burning rainforest and the earth's lungs, if you will, the rainforest, and are less efficient and more environmentally degrading per calorie produced by multiples. And that's the tough part. But you know what the tough part is? This has happened previously. Europe was really good at manufacturing, and so then they moved it away because of environmental reasons. Same thing in the United States. We've moved away some more dirty manufacturing. It didn't stop happening. It just went to China.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's local emissions versus global. So great for Netherlands that theirs will be less, but it's going to be increased somewhere else, probably at even greater cost because it's not as efficient.
Something we talked about, actually, I think it was with Dr. Holder, I think is who we talked about it with, is one of the things we don't talk about, too, is if we stop having these farms in these countries like the Netherlands that are really doing a lot as far as improving things like technological advances, we're going to be losing that technology as well, like the things that they could be creating, the things they could be inventing. And so that's like setting us back even further.
Yeah. So here's the tough part. And I've been telling my audiences for a long time, environmentalism is a religion. And you'd say this and then you'll get called climate denier and all this, but it's you've got to really pull back. You've got to have some cojones and a backbone to even say these things, because you'll be attacked. And by the way, it's another overused word. When the Japanese Imperial Forces bombed Pearl Harbor, that was an attack. You disagreeing with me on Twitter is hardly a damn attack. Let's just point that out. Anyway, you'll get maligned if you say these things, but there is some reality to this, that this is a religious-like movement, and the followers truly, it is their dogma, and they believe that we must get rid of meat production or milk production in Holland to save the environment. And I believe the worst part is those religious sign carriers, agreeers, enablers are actually just being used by greater forces. The land that's being taken by government force in the Holland is not going to then just revert to wetlands and natural habitat. It's going to be developed into housing. So who benefits from these movements? There's usually, as I always say, follow the money. Your thoughts?
Yeah. So I mean, again, this is so many different directions that I want to.
I know we got a pharmacist and an environmental scientist. I'm the one with the agricultural economics background. I say it's always about the money and the power, the money and the power.
So you talk about like it being kind of a religion. Something else that's kind of like in a religion is animal activists. And I actually think a lot of this is stemming from animal activists. I think animal activists saw an opportunity to continue their mission and change it in a way. So, okay, so maybe you don't agree with us that, you know, animal ag is bad. How could we make you agree with us? And so taking the climate approach is, I think, their newest strategy. And so, you know, maybe there were some climate activists out there, but now animal activists are now climate activists as well.
Yeah, and I'd say that obviously they got in bed together because it's a means of first off achieving the goal which they want, and also to raise money. We saw this in North Carolina. And again, I'll talk about follow the money. North Carolina, environmental activists got in bed with animal activists to then sue the largest pork production company in the world, part of Smithfield and Murphy Brown, and then trial lawyers, which of course then say, great, let's use these activist groups to create this narrative that hog farms are destroying North Carolina's environment. And also now let's push through class action lawsuits. So it's really become almost undefeatable when you figure there's the profit incentive through lawsuits, the profit incentive for fundraising, and animal activism and environmental activism also get to go and tell their donors, look what we did. We just saved the Holland's environment. By the way, we haven't heard enough on Natalie. So I know you've got plenty to say, Tara. Let's hear from our girl, Natalie, because she was getting bored. I looked at her and I saw she was over texting, which
I was looking up something I tweeted.
It kind of pissed me off. I took it personal that she was over there texting instead of paying attention to Tara and I. But you know what? Typical beef farmer versus two dairy people.
Right.
We probably got over her head. Anyway, I'm sorry, Natalie. Having fun.
No, I don't know if I'll go as far deep into maybe like a conspiracy or some of the narratives out there. Like,
did you just call me a conspiracy wacko?
Who's in bed with who? But I do think, like you said, you said it's a reality, and I stand firm in that. There is portions of this that is a reality that we need to pay attention to. And one thing you stated is that, you know, the end goal of whatever all of this is, everyone wants to get rid of animal agriculture. And at the end of the day, that means getting rid of meat. And one thing we haven't talked about yet, and this is what I was looking up is my tweet, because you talked about how everyone's talking about how, oh, they're going to save the planet then because we got rid of, you know, no more beef cows. Well, what have they actually talked about the consequences of removing these from an environmental standpoint and from a nutritional standpoint? 2 billion, we have 2 billion anemic people in the world. That's a 25% of the population is anemic. The one thing that can solve that is meat. And we're talking about taking it away. And I think that's just, it's just idiot. You know, it's just insane to me, the benefits that no one is looking at from, again, an environmental standpoint of cattle, ruminant grazing, biogenic carbon cycle, and from a nutritional standpoint. And yet we follow these narratives that the world will be better with no cows. And I just can't wrap my head around it.
Well, no, we don't. And I think there's a reality also that we in ag pay attention to it, maybe even more than our consumers. I mean, the gal that goes to yoga and is very influenced by what her yoga partner says, that meat is murder and bad for the environment, maybe. But I think the average woman that's over here at the Kroger that's shopping for her family, she doesn't buy into this. She still knows that her children love cheeseburgers and that she and her husband love sitting down and having a steak we can get away from it. Pork chop, chicken breast, whatever. So I'm not sure that it's as big of a group as we think, but it seems to be a very well-funded and well-organized minority.
A really interesting point you're bringing up is that, like, are we, as an agriculture industry, do we make a mountain out of a molehill? One thing we always talk about in advocacy is that don't pay attention to the right or the left. You know, don't pay attention, again, the echo chamber, the people in agriculture, and don't pay attention to the far left, the complete animal activists. There's a movable middle that you need to be talking to. It's generally the largest and it's generally the quietest. And so I think you're absolutely right. You know, if we polled the amount of people, the women walking into the grocery store, are they aware of some of these, you know, higher driven animal activists' goals to end animal agriculture? Probably not. But does that mean, as, you know, advocates for our industry, should we sit back and be like, well, it's not that big of an issue yet? So I think it's a very interesting point you brought up. I don't know if I have an exact answer or point to it. But
I'm surprised. We've agreed twice so far in 30 minutes. Tara, real quickly, there is a reality, though, again, speaking of realities, that I think that we in ag are more incensed by it, or we understand, you know, my dairy farmer brother before he died, if I said, you know, there's these people that want you to not exist, they actually believe you should be criminally prosecuted for all this crazy stuff. I said, but that's like half of 1%, not even like 1/10 of 1% of the population. That's this radical animal rights, you know, zealots. That's the crazy part. But there's this other thing we must admit, while those people are in a fringe minority, there are real outcomes. Look what's happened in the Netherlands. 3,000 farmers, rancher, whatever, property owners, business owners are going to be forcibly liquidated. And so you'd have a hard time not accepting that as it's happening in some places.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things we have to be careful of is, while maybe the movable middle is not aware of this, but those activists, the small minority, has a large say in organizations like the UN and the UK and the EU. Lots of U's in there. But yeah, that's where we need to be concerned. That's where we need to be really watching what's going on, keeping, you know, kind of our finger on the pulse of what's happening at the UN and how this is going to have a trickle down effect of how it will impact our countries, our legislation. You know, Natalie and I were at a conference recently. We were talking with a fast food company and they were talking about how they're moving to cage-free eggs. And we were like, really? Like, the people walking into the fast food restaurant, your customers really care about whether it's cage-free? No. They admitted it. No, but our stakeholders do. So they will have to force this on all of their millions of daily customers to be cage free, even if that's not what the customer's asking for.
And you've got activist investor shareholders that might be pushing this, but there's another part of it that, for instance, it was about a year ago that Carl Icahn, the billionaire investor's daughter, was pushing him to have McDonald's change their meat and egg acquisition process because of this whole thing. And so you're talking about what some daughter of a billionaire that wants this to happen because it becomes their cause. Mm-hmm. There's another.
I want to add one more piece to the puzzle. I don't think we've talked about with this is the way, I mean, we talked about the woman going to the grocery store right now, whether they're aware of it or not.
Man, I've got to tell you, for you two being millennial women, you'd think that you'd be a little bit more, you know, who does a grocery shopping in the Mason household? I do, especially when I'm out here in Arizona. You know why? Fry's, part of Kroger's. You know why? They have a bar. When I get done, I can sit and have a pint of craft beer. I love it. So I do the shopping too, Natalie.
All right. No, you're right. Actively shopping right now. We haven't talked about the generation to come behind us. And I think they spend a whole lot of time more on social media. I think they're maybe swayed a little bit more by these narratives out there. And I think that's one thing we aren't paying attention to is like who's coming behind that will be making decisions and how do they get their information and how are they kind of swayed?
True. And then you got to wonder, though, does it really matter? And I'm going to throw one at you that Tatar and I, her in the dairy business, it was 3 years ago in my home state of Indiana, that horrible footage of laborers, and actually it was turned out that they were actually plants tossing around calves, abusing calves on a dairy facility in Indiana. And of course it went viral and it was everywhere. And it turns out it was all completely done by, not by the Humane Society or PETA, but one of the, what's called Animal Activism Everywhere or whatever. It's one of the more upstart new animal activist groups.
Direct Action Everywhere.
Say, God, you remember that, right, Tar?
Yep.
And you say, okay, that was awful. And it's going to be terrible for dairy. And the reality is it did not change any dairy consumption at all. So there's the one thing we got to say is we see it. And they had me on media. Damien, is this what really happens? And I went to my dairy farmer's facility. I said, do these calves look like they're being mistreated? And I walked through a barn and they're, you know, fans blowing on them and dry bedding with water-free choice, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is, it didn't change milk consumption. I mean, milk consumption been going down, but it wasn't because of that terrible black eye. It essentially is just fundraising for these animal activist groups that didn't change a consumer. So to Natalie, to your point, yeah, those people behind us, the 19-year-olds that are on TikTok right now, get their information differently than grandma does or did. But does it actually change consumption? And one could say that was a great example. Not 1 pound of cheese was consumed less in the year 2018 because of it, or 2019, whatever year it was.
So I think one thing that I've been noticing a lot is, did you watch any of the footage of the kids dumping out the milk in the grocery stores, the protesters?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then the video of them gluing their ear to the Mona Lisa and throwing tomato and all, you know, I feel like a lot of these causes though are by younger people. You know, it's not older people out there starting those movements.
Well,
and
sure,
it's not, I wouldn't even argue it's, you know, above Tara and I do think it's these younger kids that are kind of falling into some of these narratives and then in a way stepping out. And so I guess maybe that was my point about it, but you're right. Maybe it doesn't affect consumption, but if we have more younger people creating those organizations, you know, what would that maybe do?
I know that it was your nature to try and disagree with me right there, but anyway, we'll certainly cause radical acting out on causes is generally done by the youth, right? I mean, a 60-year-old, former hippie might still climb up a tree to prevent a logging operation from happening. But the reality is it's usually young people that are dumping milk and burning their draft cards in the 1960s and what have you.
Their frontal lobes are still developing.
Right.
Leave it to the doctor to bring that up.
They're very easily influenced by wanting to belong. But like I said, we see it, we hear it. And you'd say, does this really move the needle on consumption? And the reality is it hasn't. So I don't know.
So I would argue with you there that we, to like kind of bring this full circle, is those stunts obviously are geared towards raising money. And raising money then gives them the platform. These activists, as we said, then go out and really have influence and sway in political fields, in UN, in all of these organizations that then come back and put regulations in place, legislation in place. And so I feel like it may not move the needle on consumption, but I do worry that it moves the needle on policy. And then in return, like just like we were saying, some billionaire's daughter can decide, you know, what you get to eat at McDonald's. Like that's where it's an issue. That's where it comes back around.
Probably, Tara, a good thing would be, maybe it doesn't move the needle on consumption today or tomorrow. It definitely moves the needle on the narrative. And one can start looking at, I've been hypercritical of Bill Gates. Bill Gates is worth, well, he was worth $86 billion, then he got divorced. So I don't know, $40 or $50 billion, let's say. He can essentially buy legislation, and he has. And Bloomberg did a big story that after the Inflation Reduction Act passed with all of its environmental initiatives, he was heavily involved in pushing that. And then you read a little further, well, Bill Gates has cadmium mines in Ecuador, third world countries where we're mining heavy metals for batteries, fake meat investments, investments in green cement companies. So behind the tough part is this movement really a lot of times is just being financed by people like Bill Gates that realize the more noise that's being made about the evils of meat might just be all the better for my investment in Beyond Burger.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more money to be made in processed foods, whatever that is, whether that's a meat alternative, than like selling a whole product, right? And I mean, obviously, we could disagree on that with like the JBSs of the world. There's probably lots of money to be made in meat as well. But I just think that a lot of these big billionaires, we just looked at lab-grown meat and looked at their, Upside Foods, who had invested in that. And so when you look at that like list of investors, it does make you question, you know, who's able to buy legislation. While at the same time, you know, Biden administration has come out saying that they want to put more money into meat alternatives as well as lab-grown meats, you know, connect the dots without being too conspiracy theorists. Like it's pretty easy.
Well, actually, you know what? I didn't call you a conspiracy theorist and you didn't call
Natalie
me,
did.
But our girl from Nebraska/-Montana, who you'd say, let's face it, didn't your state produce Ted Kaczynski and you're calling us conspiracists because we actually are out here connecting dots between profit incentive and policy. Come on, Natalie, sharpen up a little bit, sister.
I'm trying to catch up.
I'm laughing because our Zoom call, she's at them for me. She's at the bottom. You and I are at the top and Natalie's just down there fighting us at the bottom.
Hey, Natalie, I've enjoyed this. So, all right. Take me to the next thing. We've covered the environmental thing. I am, and all joking aside, I know you said to not sound too conspiratorial. I don't know how one cannot connect these dots because they are real and not come away with a conclusion that we have. I think that we have, movements afoot that are good for the movement and are good for those invested in where the movement creates an outcome. And you'd be silly not to say, okay, humans are motivated by money and their own self-interest. My people in the logging industry told me that they just call it the conflict industry. They said, just like we're in the wood and timber and lumber business, we know that these people are in, they sell conflict. That's what they do. And I think that when we in ag view it as the business that it is, maybe the person outside of Whole Foods marching around with their sign that, you know, beef is bad for the environment or whatever, that person maybe isn't in the industry, but they're being used by those that are in the industry. What are your thoughts?
Well, absolutely. I think that, I mean, Tara, you talked a little bit about this. You've been inside animal activist Facebook groups where they have to remind people, you know, don't show up wearing leather. Here's what you're supposed to say. Here are the talking points. So absolutely, I believe that those larger organizations are preying on people who don't do their due diligence to understand certain things or are maybe swayed a little bit easier. I support that.
People are looking for a cause. And so they join up with this cause without actually realizing all of the details. And that was, the letter I saw. It was a letter that went out to activists that were going to protest at a farm. And they literally had to remind them what they were protesting for.
By the way, Tara, I would say you said they're looking for a cause. I think when I said environmental is a religion, I think they're looking for a belonging. And they're being utilized, but there really is this thing when you say I'm 19 to Natalie's point, they're young people, they're sitting around smoking weed, and they need something to be opposed to, they need something to feel belonging to. And I've been making my point to agricultural audiences for a long time. My mom's space at the Catholic pew where she sat every day for 70 years is not being replaced. Organized religion is losing followers, but that does not mean that there are not new religions. And being opposed to meat or the environment, whatever environmentalism is, it's a very loose religious tent, right? It's whatever you say it is. And then you can be opposed to Natalie and her husband producing, you know, fine beef in Nebraska.
And I think that's actually one of the scary things about the vegan lifestyle is that it is more of a religion and place to belong. I know people who were once vegan and are now no longer. And they talk about how, you know, they couldn't ask certain things. They were afraid to talk a certain way. They felt like, I mean, it was almost this brainwashing thing that they look back on now and they can't really, you know, understand how they got, how far they got. And so I do think that that's one of the scariest things about, you know, that those different lifestyles is exactly what you said, is that it is almost just a place to belong. But it gets very dangerous because it affects so many, like their ripple goes out pretty far of when they start dictating who, you know, how other people should be eating and living their lives.
Yeah, well, I covered it in my in that book right there that right now, depending on which data you try and pull, those that are in the vegetarian lifestyle will tell you that 8% of Americans are vegan to vegetarian. And the data just does not in any way actually back that up. It's less than 2%, maybe less than 1%. It's tremendously difficult to be a vegan. You know, you almost can't do it. And it's hard even to be a vegetarian. And then there's those that say they're vegetarian, but they, you know, they lapse and they eat
flexitarian. It's a flexitarian, I think.
If they use that term, but they like to say that they're vegetarian when they're really not.
Yeah.
Anyway, we should probably try and get out of here. I can sit here and talk to the girls all day, even though there's been, we'll call it subtle insults, right, Tara?
I mean, backhanded. We heard. I think those are called backhanded compliments.
We heard them. What else you got for me on the way out of here? I said we're going to cover environmental stuff. We did animal activism. We did the conflict industry. We did. Being at your age and where you are, you both had professional careers and now are doing this thing. Am I right? I know that you were an environmental scientist, Tara. You had a professional career and here you are, Natalie.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
Not that what you're doing now is not professional, but I mean professional career in the traditional sense. You had a job somewhere in town, whatever, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I was a full-time pharmacist and I was living in a bigger city, which is a relative term in Montana. But I mean, going back to what I was going to say, I never actually even thought I would stay in agriculture. I didn't think I'd marry a rancher. I was close to our family ranch, but I didn't think my income would come from agriculture. And so it kind of came full circle for me when I married my husband. And then, like you said, to step away from pharmacy to now just share online as my profession. It's definitely interesting. It's unique. I don't think my parents understand what I do. I don't think a lot of people understand, you know, that this is our job. But I guess that's, you know, 2022. You can make an income out of sharing online, you know, about something you're passionate about.
Tara.
Yeah, similar. I mean, I worked as an environmental consultant for a decade for a company that was, you know, a 9-to-5 job, essentially. And to leave that, I think that I had a lot of people in my life that thought it was crazy that I left my job to share on social media. I mean, it's more than that, though. It's very hard to explain kind of what we do. As Natalie said, not everyone even doesn't know what we do in our family. But it is, there's so many opportunities. And I feel like living in a small town, being able to share online has opened so many doors across the country, across the globe, for both of us to be able to, you know, really reach outside of our small towns and have these opportunities. It is weird to make your money from an app. Just this morning, I was having a conversation with my husband, who's now sharing on social media as well, that Facebook changed something for us, and it will literally impact how much money that piece of our company will make next month. And that's kind of wild to think about.
Yeah. And the tough part is, you know, and I think about this also, you know, I've been out here a little longer than you two. I was a personality on a stage then. Now I use social media and the internet as a means of reaching my audience. One means, and also promoting. And yours is a little bit the inverse.
Yeah. I would say we both started just sharing online, and then it turned into an opportunity for us to have a platform and to share and to be able to speak and do a lot of different things. So almost, yeah, the exact opposite of what your career path.
My career path. 5 years from now, Natalie, 10 years from now, where's the industry going to go? Where's Natalie going to go?
Well, our industry isn't going to go anywhere, as we've talked about in this, this whole podcast, this whole conversation.
There'll be fewer people in the production. I mean, consolidation has been the rule for the last 1,000 years of production agriculture. So there'll be less people, but there's already not very many people out where you are. What do you see happening? Where's it go?
The industry?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think there. I mean, like you said, I mean, there are going to be changes to it, whether that's, 100,000 less ranches and farms or, whatever that number is, we'll see shifts and change. But I think overall, if you don't lose yourself like in the brushstrokes and you step back and look at the painting, we're producing the food and fiber of the world. So like our industry, I think as a whole, I mean, you'll have technological advances and changes, but at the end of the day, we have to put a meal on the plate 3 times a day for everyone across the world. So
with that being said, what's the one thing that concerns you with all the stuff we've talked about? I agree with you that we're fine. And actually that the good news is I think there's a lot of our consumers that seem the whole pandemic going to the store and seeing empty shelves kind of scared the bejesus out of them. We've probably been as appreciated or as understood of our necessity as an industry as much in the last 3 years as we have in my 50, right?
Yeah. I mean, you ask kind of a loaded question of what concerns.
I do that. Natalie, I not only ask loaded questions, I'm sometimes very difficult to get along with, as you're noticing.
But I guess when I think about what concerns me, I don't look too far forward or too far outside my inner core. I mean, maybe that's selfish, but, I really look at as a mom of 3 boys, what concerns me is what we're doing on our operation to if the next generation wants to come back. And then if the next generation doesn't, what that means for us, too.
And by the way, you came back sort of kind of.
I know.
And you were well into your.
I was far out there. I don't know how the industry got its claws in me and pulled me back in, but it did.
Well, there's the other point, though, about your children. They might be 30 and you think, yeah, they work in Omaha in the healthcare system, just kind of like you did. And like, oh, no. And there you are. So it's not like you're gone and gone forever. Right.
No. And I mean, I don't worry about, I know this wasn't your question, but I'm not the type that's like someone has to take over our operation. I think my husband definitely is. I mean, I ask him all the time. I'm like, why are we working so hard? These 3 boys might not even want to come back, and I don't know maybe it would make me sad. I can't put myself that far in the future to know, whether I'll be heartbroken if a boy doesn't return or not. But, I don't ever want to put pressure on them to come back because my parents gave me the gift of choice. And I hope I do that the same for my kids.
You know what? You say, why are you working so hard? I don't have children. My wife and I don't have children. And I've bought all the farm ground that I have. I didn't, I'm one of 9 that came from almost nothing. So I've never looked at it as working hard to create something to give to a kid, to an agricultural legacy. I kind of looked at it as this is important to me. And maybe that's what's in us. If you've got the ag gene, if you will, whether you're trying to pass it on, it's more just like doing right now kind of thing. So Tara.
Yeah. So this is kind of, I feel like my soapbox I'm on right now, as far as where the industry is headed. I think that, we can talk about consolidation, and I think it actually is not change. I think there will be continued consolidation, but I think that you have to be within an organized food supply system. That will be the future, is that, a end product person, company, brand, whatever it is, will want to work with a certain producer. Basically, whether that's beef producer, dairy producer, whether that's inside of a co-op or something like that, but it will all be an organized supply chain. I think that's where we're headed.
All be an organized supply chain. I wonder if there's going to be a whole bunch more of them. When you look at it, there are more SKUs on the grocery shelf today than there ever have been in the history of the United States of America, which for the last 100 years has been as opulent and as good, as well off of, as well fed of a country as there is on the planet. There was not Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, organic food at Walmart. When you really think about it, it's a great time to be a consumer. And so I really have said where I think the future goes is there's going to be massive commodity production, like the, you know, the soybeans or large dairy or whatever. And there's obviously going to be more and more niches that can satisfy the thing. So when you think about our consumer, right now, Natalie and her husband can produce Scottish Highland beef that are all blessed by a rabbi and named Clarence and find somebody online that wants to buy that more so than ever could have existed.
Absolutely. Before. Completely agree. So I think that there, I think there's consolidation and I think there's opportunity for niche markets as well. Like there's both because our consumer, if we've learned one thing about our consumer in the last 10 years, is they want choices and they want all the choices. And so being able to give them that choice, there will be somebody out there that will buy your product. And especially if you can share it about it online.
That's the one thing. And I know I'm going long here, but that's okay. This has been a long episode because it's a good one because we both have plenty to say. About that. And I think that Natalie touched on this about like, value added and some things like this. It's common in the commodity producer, rancher, farmer mentality, just like they're not necessarily salespeople, they're producers, to then always think sell to the bottom. And you'll even hear, you know, commodity producer mentality, like, you believe that they're getting $37 for a bushel of organic soybeans. Hell, they're only worth 14. Like, you know what? Why, instead of bashing that, don't you think of ways to emulate that and create more value for a consumer base? You know, all joking about the Scottish Highland cattle named Clarence that are blessed by a rabbi, any way that you can do this. And I find it that that marketing, that promotion, that creativity, that entrepreneur side is actually probably more with us now than it has throughout my life, where it was all just commodity mindset. And I applaud it. Bring more margin to the farming operation. And to your point, social media and online has allowed this.
Any product is worth as much as you can get someone to pay for it. Like it's not, you know, when a farmer's like, oh, it's only worth, it's like, no, it's actually worth whatever you can convince someone to pay for it and enough people to pay for it. And part of that is telling a story online, sharing about it, having people feel connected to the product, the brand, all of that. Yeah. I mean, as heebie-jeebie era, not heebie-jeebie, what would it be like foo-foo?
Touchy-feely
as that is like the truth of being able to market your product.
Natalie, you get the last word, my dear.
Wow. I thought Tara did such a good job. Why?
All right.
Well, the second part of your question was, where are we headed? So maybe Natalie, you want to share on that?
Oh yeah. The future 5 years for Natalie and Tara will hopefully be, we're working hard on our podcast and, a docuseries. So, maybe you'll catch us on the big screen there. And then we can be real starlets. You introduced us as starlets, but we're aiming to be real ones. So
if anybody wants to find what you do, where do they go?
Our podcast is Discover Ag, and then they can find us on our individual channels at Natalie Kovorek, at Tara Vander Dusen.
Natalie and Tara aired last week. As you're listening to this, go back and check it out. They aired an episode that I did with my friend and co-host Todd Thurman about what an aging and shrinking population means for agriculture. So we're attempting to elevate each other as we elevate ag, and I'm glad that they came on this podcast to do that. So check them out. It's called Elevate. It's called
our podcast Discover Ag.
And if they want to find you on Instagram, is where you both spend a tremendous amount of time and have a lot of presence, right?
Yep.
And you can find us at Tara Vander Dusen
and then at Natalie Kovorek.
That's Kovark with several K's and a couple of V's. Anyway, Kovark is what? K-O-V-A-R-I-C-K. And Van Der Dusen is Van like down by the river. D-E-R-D-U-S-S-E-N.
Correct.
Got it. Tara Van Der Dusen and Natalie Kovark. They are awesome. And I'm glad they came on here. And we had a lot to say. And I know this is a long episode, but it was worth it. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You bet. Till next time. Thanks for being here. It's the Business of Agriculture. Well, that concludes another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. This episode was brought to you by Pattern Ag. You know, everybody in agriculture understands the importance of soil health. We also keep an eye on our soil better than we ever did through advanced soil testing. But what if there was a company that provided predictive analytics? Not just checking out nutrients and all the elements that are in there, but also could tell you the degree of risk you face with disease and pest pressure. That's right. Pattern Ag can do that. They actually can tell you, hey, you're going to have a real issue here. You can preemptively, proactively treat for corn rootworm or cyst nematode or sudden death syndrome before the problem actually starts costing you yield. Go to pattern.ag. That's www.pattern.ag to find the nearest rep that can help you start doing better for your soil.